listener production.
Hey, Bension Siebert here with The Briefing. Sydney's Westfield Bondi Junction shopping centre reopened today, not for trading, but for quiet reflection in the wake of Saturday's stabbing attacks. As further information comes to light about the attack and those involved, we learnt this week that 40-year-old Queensland man Joel Couchy, who carried out the attack, was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a teenager. He and his family spent more than 20 years trying to navigate the challenges the condition brings. It's important to note that just because someone experiences schizophrenia doesn't mean that they'll be violent or dangerous to the community. But what impact can it have on a person who experiences it, and how can it be treated? And how do families and loved ones of those who live with the condition deal with its challenges? Professor Patrick McGorry is a former Australian of the Year and career advocate for people experiencing mental illness, who's currently Executive Director of Origin, a mental health crisis service for young people. Professor McGorry joined Simon Beaton to shed some light on the condition.
Professor McGorry, thanks for joining us. To start off, what is schizophrenia?
Well, schizophrenia is one of the more serious forms of mental illness. And like all forms of mental illness, it usually emerges in adolescence and young adults for the first time. It affects all areas of a person's sort of mental functioning. Their perception of the world can be very distorted by hallucinations and perceptual disturbances. Their concentration and, their cognitive abilities can be affected. They can have delusional beliefs, so they have they might feel persecuted by known or unknown people when that's actually not actually occurring. They can be have delusions about that. Then they'll also have very unusual religious or sometimes bizarre delusions about aliens and whatever technology is dominant at the time in history. And they often feel that their brains are being sort of impacted on by various forms of technology, or even by other people inserting thoughts or ideas into their heads. So it's a very disturbing experience. It doesn't come on suddenly. It comes on slowly, and there are warning signs for it, which we've capitalized on in our intervention work. So you can just imagine if a person's experiencing all of those distorting and distracting experiences, that it's very difficult for them to function in relationships or to study or work while the illness is untreated.
Well, how pronounced are those symptoms or behaviours?
Well, they can be mild, but as it goes through its various stages, if it's not picked up, it can get very entrenched and intense, and it can completely take over the person's behaviour. And that's why you see such tragedies, in a very small number of cases where they might attack other people, because they're afraid of being attacked themselves on the basis of delusions. And I stress that most people with schizophrenia are much less dangerous than the average person walking around the street. But there is a subgroup, if they're not properly treated and supported, that they, when they're unwell, they can harm other people, as we saw on the weekend.
Yeah, well, tell me a little bit more about the treatment. Where are we at now?
Okay, well, in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, there was no really effective treatment. People were warehoused in old mental institutions, asylums, and they were very disturbing and places with a lot of suffering. And it was a custodial way of treatment because there really wasn't a way of helping people recover. But in the 1950s, they discovered new medications that would actually either remove all of these psychotic experiences like hallucinations and delusions, or moderate them so that they didn't interfere with the person's life so much. And that allowed the mental hospitals to be gradually closed around the world. And I should say also there are a lot of other forms of treatment, not just drug therapies, that are helpful to people in managing or recovering from schizophrenia: psychological therapies, social therapies, even practical vocational recovery programs to help them return to study and work when they get better. The problem in Australia is that hardly any services provide these interventions in a evidence-based and high-fidelity way because of the underfunding and neglect of mental health care.
Is someone with the condition more likely than another without to commit acts of violence?
Yeah, the vast majority of people are not aggressive or violent. But there is a subgroup if they're not properly treated. And it's not because they're bad people or they're...
Of course. Yeah.
There's a character problem. It's the illness affects their brain and behavior in such a way that poses a risk to themselves and others. So this man died himself on the weekend, so he was at risk as well because of the lack of treatment. So, and the only way to fix that is not to somehow pick winners, where you try to screen through all the people with schizophrenia and find out who the violent ones are. That's not the right way to approach reducing community risk. The only way to do that is to treat everybody effectively, because this boy would never have been picked up if there'd been a screening approach, because he was never violent or aggressive. And when he was treated, he functioned normally, you know, and the mistake was, because he was functioning normally, they took him off the treatment, but they thought he didn't need it. And of course, he got very, very ill, became homeless and lost from all his connections and ended up where he did. And at that point, he was highly dangerous to others and ultimately to himself. So, and the only way to prevent those things happening, and there would be hundreds of patients wandering around Australia at the moment in that situation that he was in,
yeah,
out of touch with services, untreated, with a severe illness, because our system is simply not funded to provide care to all of those who need it in an evidence-based way.
Yeah, well, I mean, on that, is there the suggestion that in the wake of the Richmond report into mental health care in the 1980s that we're failing the mentally ill by not locking them up? Instead, as was a recommendation of the Richmond report, we try to encourage them and support them to live in the community.
And that can be done. I mean, the programs that have been developed since then, highly evidence-based, multi-component programs, where they have been put on deck in various oases around the world, they do the job. But
yeah,
the problem is the governments haven't done that. They started to do it in New South Wales and they started to do it in Victoria, but they didn't invest enough money so that you had enough coverage of all the patients that needed it. So they ended up getting what's called episodes of care, which might last from a few days or weeks, either in hospital or in the community. And as soon as they settle, like this boy, they get flicked back to the GP, and primary care is not what it used to be either.
Yeah,
so
right.
The GP is somehow expected to monitor this person and pick up when they're becoming unwell. And often when they are becoming unwell, they don't turn up for GP appointments. The GPs don't chase them, can't chase them. So there's no safety net. You know? And so the system is built to about a third of the scale or less of what it really should be. There's no long-term care, and there's certainly no long-term beds like the old asylums used to provide. And there is a subgroup of patients who need those long-term beds too. So the system is half-baked, totally underfunded, demoralised and poorly led because it's such a difficult job. It's a low priority in the health system, and yet it's the number one health issue which would strengthen Australia from a health point of view. It's much more important than cancer or NDIS or any of the things that are very well funded in terms of producing a healthy and safe Australia.
How about in terms of as a society and regular people? I mean, like, we wouldn't walk past someone having a heart attack, but we do routinely walk away from the mentally ill. But are Australians learning to be more respectful for those with mental health, which, after all, is a medical condition like most others?
I think they are, and that's been helped by the fact that anxiety and depression, which are common mental disorders that most people have seen or experienced or relate to, at least 50% of us will have had those experiences over a lifetime. So those things are more understood and responded to, but I don't think the public understand the more serious forms of mental illness like anorexia, like schizophrenia, like bipolar, like borderline personality, and like addictions. They're very judgmental and afraid of those illnesses. So Beyond Blue stuck to its knitting and just focused on anxiety and depression. But there's no effort like a Beyond Blue for these other forms of mental illness. And we probably need to reinvent Beyond Blue so it becomes beyond everything.
Yeah, and I mentioned you're executive director of Origin, a mental health service for young people. What should I or a listener do if I'm worried about my child? Can I or should I speak to someone first without raising it with my loved one?
It's definitely important to have a dialogue about it if you notice behavioural or other changes in the emerging adult. It's especially important in these teenagers and young adults. Younger children do have mental health problems, but they're much less common than they are in this teenage and young adult group, where they've gone up by 50% since 2007 in that teenage young adult age group. to a staggering level of 39% in 2021. So we have a youth mental health crisis on our hands. So almost every family with more than, say, one or two kids is going to see this and grapple to find help. Help is hard to find. We have built Headspace around Australia as a first port of call, but Headspace is underfunded and needs to be redesigned and refinanced. We've been talking to Mark Butler about that. It's urgent. We have developed a highly evidence-based template and blueprint to do that. That's available to the federal and state governments if they are serious about tackling this youth mental health crisis. And so I think if we want to prevent tragedies like Bondi, we've got to do this. And it's all very well, you know, arming the security guards with pepper sprays and, you know, basically, you know, increasing security and getting more defensive, but that is not going to work. It simply won't work.
Yeah, for sure. And there's what's one thing that I can do or someone who's listening can do if they come across someone having a mental health crisis?
Yeah. Well, try to speak to them, try to listen. If you see a distressed person, there is a concept called mental health first aid, which is the right idea. Try to sort of learn some basic skills in talking to someone who's tearful or agitated or even angry. That's a little bit more scary for most people. But just if you have a calm demeanor and you just try to listen and not do anything to start off with, and just indicate that you're willing to help and if you can, that's probably the best thing to do. And just be open and not afraid, because most people who are distressed are not aggressive or violent. As I say, they're much more likely to be victims than perpetrators of anything. If there is a threat of aggression or violence, or if the person doesn't seem to be in touch with reality, like if they appear to be drug affected or if they're psychotic, then you definitely need to get first responders involved, like ambulance and police.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Some brilliant advice there. Thank you so much, Professor McGorry, for your time.
Oh, thanks very much for the opportunities.
Professor Patrick McGorry, Executive Director of Origin, a mental health crisis service for young people, speaking there with The Briefing's Simon Beaton. You can find Origin via origin.org.au. Thanks for joining us on The Briefing. Check back in your feed tomorrow morning when the team brings you a chat exploring the difficulties surrounding choosing juries when the world's eyes are on Donald Trump and the case in New York. We talked to the judge in Brittany Higgins' trial about how difficult it can be to find impartial jurors. I'm Ben Sion-Siebert. Catch you next time.